Am I the only one who seems like time just flies? Birthdays come around about once a month. I think that happens when you've had a bunch of them. It's hard to believe. Inside, I still feel about 15, 16. Maturity level of about 11. Here I sit, staring at 75 next Thursday. It's amazing. This is lesson number 59, Book of Genesis. Title of today's lesson is The Second Journey, The Test for Jealousy. I've chosen an opening scripture today from the third chapter of James. So we'll take just a second and read through that because it's pertinent to some of the things we'll be talking about later. This is from James 3, verses 14 through 16. But if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast and live falsely with regard to the truth. This is not the wisdom that comes down from above, but is earthly, unspiritual, and demonic. For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there will be disorder in every vile practice. To be jealous is to resent someone because of that person's success or advantages. Biblically speaking, jealousy is rooted in coveting. And by extension, when we desire things that other people have and we do so with the wrong attitude, you can admire someone's car and not covet it. But if you think you should have it instead of them, that can be a problem. When we do this, we break the 10th commandment. I want you to listen to the word of the Lord regarding coveting and by extension jealousy that was recorded by Moses in the 20th chapter of Exodus, the 10th commandment. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his male servant or his female servant or his ox or his donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. When we look into the New Testament, we find that Paul agrees with Moses. Paul writes, "What shall we say then? Is the law sin? May it never be. On the contrary, I would not have come to know sin except through the law. For I would not have known coveting if the law had not said, 'Thou shalt not covet.'" It's important to understand the danger of this particular sin because we're surrounded by it. It's implicit to the adage that we've all heard and perhaps have at times said, keeping up with the Joneses. And coveting, along with its byproduct, jealousy, are foundational to critical theory and Marxism, two interrelated philosophies that run rampant on most college campuses today in America and in Western Europe. We should not be surprised by this because coveting is the default position of mankind after the fall. I chose these verses for our consideration today because they highlight the evil consequences of harboring jealousy toward others. And there's little question that jealousy on the part of Joseph's brothers is ultimately what led to the dilemma that they're now facing in Egypt. So it's at the heart of what we're studying today. And let's not forget that underpinning these Joseph narratives that we've been studying is the continuing theme of the providential hand of God expressed through the interplay between God's eternal purpose and the afflictions of the sons of Jacob that they're experiencing in Egypt. You may recall that God chose to remove Jacob's descendants temporarily from the land of Canaan, where the covenant family was losing its unique identity. God chose to relocate this family to Egypt, where they would be isolated from the influence of the Canaanite culture. In Egypt, they'll grow into that great nation God had promised to Abraham years before, and it will be in partial fulfillment of the Abrahamic covenant. But there's a problem. It's a big problem. If it's God's plan to reestablish Jacob's family in Egypt as a unified people, committed to the worship of Yahweh and faithful to the covenant God made with Abraham, then the family needs to be united. And it isn't. An egregious sin has been committed against Joseph by Jacob's sons, and they've been anything but faithful servants of Yahweh, having committed a series of grievous acts. I want you to think of Shechem and Tamar and Dothan. They've engaged continuously in behavior that's unworthy of the covenant family. And since the goal here is unification, and since sin is a disintegrating force, not a unifying force, then God must deal with it. God never overlooks sin. His attribute of perfect justice requires him to deal with sin when it occurs, and that's what he will be doing here in today's passage. The disunity of Jacob's family is something God intends to rectify, and he is rectifying it through the events that take place in Egypt. In a chapter that records both an historical event and an interesting story, chapter 43 of Genesis goes beyond both of these things to what the Germans call Heilsgeschichte, which is sacred history. And what I want you to understand about this is that, as I'm using that term, the Joseph narratives record the story of God working in literal history. Literal history. These events actually occurred. It is God working in literal history, but with a purpose that goes beyond history. So we must ask, how will God accomplish his purpose with this covenant family? Well, it's going to involve something that God often uses to bring men to repentance, and that thing is affliction. Hosea 5:15 cites God's own words regarding this. God says, I will go and return to my place until they acknowledge their offense and seek my face. Then he adds, in their affliction, they will seek me early. The afflictions that are occurring here are the famine that God brought on Egypt and Canaan, and then the particular trials which Joseph is using to test his brothers. When something devastating like a famine occurs, our natural reaction is to think that things are going to get better. So in this sense, we're pretty much all optimists. It just seems like surely at any minute, things are going to return to their former state. And sometimes they don't. When the famine hit Canaan 2 years before these events in Egypt, Jacob probably believed it was going to be short-lived. And if not, he could send his boys down to Egypt maybe once, maybe twice, to buy grain. Then the rains would come and things would resume the way they had been previously. And of course, that's not at all what happened. Jacob knows any trip down to Egypt is dangerous. It's replete with many hazards. There were no highway patrolmen or policemen to keep the thieves and robbers off the roads, and there were just all sorts of hazards that could befall a person, and that's if things went well. So this is a particularly risky trip. It's particularly that way because of some events that occurred on their first expedition down to Egypt. So they're already sort of in a problem state before they ever leave for the second trip. Simeon, their brother, is in jail. He's possibly under threat of execution if Jacob's sons don't return with Benjamin, if you recall the story that we've been studying. Benjamin's the one brother who seems to be the object of Joseph's primary interest. And if Simeon is not executed, well, he might be kept in Egypt as a slave by this man against whom any opposition would be futile. And of course, no one but Joseph knows Simeon's not really under threat of execution. He's not really under threat of permanent incarceration, because other than God himself, Joseph is the only person on earth who knows what's really going on. Everyone else is basing their conclusions on what they can see.
Hey,
so,
Joseph,
yes, sir.
If he wasn't godly, would have taken them all out.
Yeah.
It's so obvious.
Yes, yeah. Yes. All Jacob knows is all of his sons may be imprisoned, enslaved, or executed, depending on the mood of this one man against whom Opposition is futile. The man who has great authority over all of Egypt. The boys have already been accused of espionage, and now they may well be convicted as thieves because of the incident with regard to the returned money that Jeff taught us about last week. At the very least, even if they get away with their lives, their ability to buy food is controlled by this same man who also is the impending threat. So they have all kinds of issues to deal with. And adding to their anxiety is their conviction that a divine reckoning is imminent, if not already in play, because of what they had done years earlier to their brother Joseph. And of course, it's of utmost importance to remember Joseph, whom the brothers have not yet recognized, has already told them they can't return to Egypt without Benjamin. As far as they know, if they don't return, Simeon will be trapped there permanently in an Egyptian prison. And other than Egypt, there's no place else to buy food for their families or for their animals. But despite these things, Jacob is understandably reluctant to allow Benjamin to go because already two of his sons are missing, one of whom is presumed dead. And to add to his dilemma, I don't think he really fully trusts his sons. I think he sees a little bit too much of himself in them. Maybe they're incompetent, or worse, maybe they'll fold under the pressure and Benjamin will be lost just as Joseph was lost. Both of Rachel's sons lost forever. But none of these things changes the fact that there's a famine and Jacob's running out of food and he's running out of time. So this is where chapter 43 begins, with Jacob facing a difficult decision. And there seem to be no good options. So what I want to do today, I usually sort of read these passages in little sections. I want to read through chapter 34 today so we have the context of the full chapter. Beginning with verse 1. Now the famine was severe in the land. So it came about when they finished eating the grain which they had brought from Egypt that their father said to them, "Go back and buy us a little food." Judah spoke to him, however, saying, "The man solemnly warned us, 'You shall not see my face again unless your brother is with you.' If you send our brother with us, we'll go down and buy food. But if you do not send him, we're not going to go down, for the man said to us, 'You will not see my face unless you bring your brother with you.'" And I think implicit in this is they're thinking that not only could bad things happen, but if we can't see his face, we can't buy food. It's going to be a futile effort to try to do this. Verse 6. And notice the name here. "And Israel said," this is Jacob. Remember, God changed Jacob's name to Israel, and we'll talk about this in a moment. "Then Israel," or Jacob, "said, 'Why do you treat me so badly by telling, why did you treat me so badly by telling the man that you had another brother?' But they said, 'The man questioned us, particularly about our relatives, saying, Is your father still alive? Have you another brother?' So we answered his questions. How could we possibly know, he would say, 'Bring your brother down.' Judah said to his father Israel, 'Send the lad with me, and we will arise and go, that we may live and not die, as well as you and our little ones. I myself will be surety for him. You can hold me responsible for him if I do not bring him back to you and set him before you. Then let me bear the blame before you forever. For if we had not delayed, surely now we could have returned twice.' Then their father Israel said to them, 'If it must be so, then do this. Take some of the best products of the land in your bags and carry down to the man carry them down to the man as a present, a little balm, little honey, aromatic gum, and myrrh, pistachio nuts, and almonds. Take double the money in your hand, and take back to your hand the money that was returned in the mouth of your sacks. Perhaps it was a mistake. Take your brother also and arise, return to the man. And may God Almighty grant you compassion in the sight of the man, so that he will release to you your other brother, Benjamin. And as for me, if I'm bereaved of my children, I'm bereaved.' So the men took this present, and they took double the money in their hand. They took Benjamin, Then they arose and went down to Egypt and stood before Joseph. When Joseph saw Benjamin with them, he said to his house steward, "Bring the men into the house and slay an animal and make ready, for the men are to dine with me at noon." So the man did as Joseph said and brought the men to Joseph's house. Now the men were afraid because they were brought to Joseph's house, and they said, "It's because of the money that was returned in our sacks the first time that we're being brought in, so that he may seek an occasion against us and fall upon us and take us for slaves along with our donkeys." So they came near to Joseph's house steward and spoke to him at the entrance of the house. And they said, "Oh, my Lord, we indeed came down the first time to buy food. And it came about when we came to the lodging place that we opened our sacks, and behold, each man's money was in the mouth of his sack, our money in full. So we brought it back in our hand. We've also brought down other money in our hand to buy food. We do not know who put the money in our sacks." And he, that is the steward, said, "Be at ease. Do not be afraid. Your God and the God of your father has given you treasure in your sacks. I had your money." Then he brought Simeon out to them. The man brought the men into Joseph's house, and he gave them water and washed their feet, and he gave their donkeys fodder. So they prepared the present for Joseph, who was coming at noon, for they had heard that they were to eat a meal there. When Joseph came home, they brought into the house to him the present which was in their hand, and they bowed to the ground before him. That's a significant phrase. Then he asked them about their welfare, and he said, "Is your father well, of whom you spoke? Is he still alive?" And they said, "Your servant, our father, is well. He's still alive." And once again, they bowed down in homage. And he lifted his eyes, and he saw his brother Benjamin, his mother's son. And he said, "Is this your younger brother of whom you spoke to me?" And he said, "May God be gracious to you, my son." Joseph hurried out, for he was deeply stirred over his brother. And he went to a place to weep. And he entered into his chamber, and there he wept. Then he washed his face and came out, and he controlled himself and said, "Serve the meal." So they served him by himself and them by themselves, and the Egyptians who ate with him by themselves, because the Egyptians could not eat bread with the Hebrews, for that's a loathsome thing to the Egyptians. Now they were seated before him, the firstborn according to his birthright, and the youngest according to his youth. And the men looked at one another in astonishment. He took portions to them from his own table, but Benjamin's portion was five times as much as theirs. So they feasted and they drank with him freely. The first word in a Hebrew sentence is said to be in the emphatic position. In other words, the first word in the Hebrew, and it doesn't necessarily correspond to the English. The first word in the Hebrew sentence is ra'av, the word that's translated famine. What's important here is it's by the way the syntax works here, the text is pointing out that the famine is going to be the thing that drives everything that takes place in this chapter. It's the famine that is the singular reality that underpins all of Jacob's decisions. So when we read they had finished eating the grain they had brought from Egypt, our attention turns then to Jacob's circumstances. And we're to interpret his actions in light of those circumstances. So it shouldn't surprise us that the word for famine is derived from the word Hebrew word that means to be hungry, and I guess that's pretty obvious. But the fact is, the rationing of their remaining supplies is leaving Jacob's family famished. They're being pushed to the limit at this point. And Jacob's faced with a serious dilemma. He would prefer to keep Benjamin safely at home. It's simply not an option, however, at this point. And the weight of this decision is made worse by the constant memory of the loss of Joseph, whom at another time he had sent on a far less dangerous mission, yet never to see his son again. The second word in the Hebrew text of verse 1 is kavod, which is the word that describes the famine as being severe. The root meaning of kavod is heavy or weighty, which accurately describes the nature not only of the famine, but also it describes the decision that Jacob must make. And we can infer from verse 2 that they've eaten most of the food that they purchased on the first trip. Only a small amount remains that has to sustain them and their animals until another trip can be made to Egypt. So with the food almost gone, Jacob must decide what to do. And he finally makes a decision. As a last resort, he says, go again to Egypt and buy some food. It's hard to know exactly how much time has passed or even how much food you could transport in a single trip. I don't know how many donkeys they had. We know from Judah's words in verse 10, enough time had passed at least for a couple of trips to have been made to and from Egypt. And the speculation that I suggested in one of our previous lessons is that a round trip to Egypt would take 50 to 60 days, allowing for some time there to recover and actually transact the purchase of the food. So I would think at least 3 months have elapsed, and probably a lot more than that has passed by. And you can't help but wonder about Simeon. Has he concluded his brothers have done to him what he did to Joseph, and quite frankly, what he might have done to them if the tables were turned, namely to abandon them in Egypt? During the time Simeon remained imprisoned, he would have wondered about his own fate, because likely he didn't trust his brothers any more than Jacob did. And truth be known, he probably trusted them less. It's just a fact, even though we might like to think otherwise, parents never quite find out everything the kids did. I'm thankful for that in some ways, particularly when my parents were alive. There were some things I'd just rather keep to myself, and I think that's the case here. But in this instance, though Jacob may have had his suspicions, Simeon knew exactly what happened to Joseph, and he knew exactly who was primarily responsible for what had been done to his brother. As for Joseph, his confidence in his brothers probably waned every day they didn't return with Benjamin. He had to wonder if they were going to be faithful and truthful and come back to Egypt. It would not be surprised to me if even in Egypt the availability of food for purchase was limited. Verse 2, the phrase, buy us a little food, it could indicate that Egypt was rationing the food that they actually sold, limiting the quantity that could be taken out of the country. Some of you here, as I see from some gray hair out there, will remember the gasoline rationing of the 1970s. Jeff remembers it, I can tell. Many of you don't. The shocking thing to me during that time is that gasoline actually got up to $1 a gallon.
Yeah. So it was terrible. The world's coming to an end.
Yeah, how are we going to? I have actually bought gasoline, premium gasoline, for my GTO when I was in high school for 17.9 cents per gallon.
Yeah. Yeah. I can remember 12 cents.
Yeah. I know that's hard for some of you to believe, but. So gasoline was rationed in the 70s. For those of you who are younger, they would sell you like 5 gallons. And so you would drive early to a gasoline station and get in a line that might last an hour. And you go buy 5 gallons, and of course you had to come back the next day. And Chip, I don't know if you know this. I'll tell a quick story. This is not in my notes, but the guy Chip and I both worked for, Chip's brother-in-law, name was Quiz. He actually visited our class once. He called a sales meeting, and he said to the salespeople, he said, you are forbidden to go sit in gasoline lines during the business day when you need to be out making cold calls. And, of course, he ignored a couple of things. One thing he ignored is that the gas stations usually shut down by 2 o'clock. That's as late as they stayed open. And so I went in and had a conversation with him. And I said, well, Quiz, how are you doing this? And he kind of looked embarrassed. And he said, we've got 2 cars and Sherry goes and sits in line.
Well, and Rashi, remember that by license plate, you went on certain days.
Yeah, you could odd and even. Yeah, it was a mess. Yeah. So I think something like this may be going on in Egypt, and probably for good reason. Joseph was shrewd. And he would have been conservative about this. I bet you anything he was rationing the food that went out of Egypt. When we get to verse 3, Judah speaks for the group. Judah's actually the fourth son of Jacob. And you might think, well, why is he the spokesman for the group? But if you remember, Simeon, Reuben, and Levi, all three are older, but each of these, by his own sin, sacrificed his right to act in the role as the elder son. So Judah speaks, and he states the condition Joseph set regarding this return to Egypt, a condition Jacob already knows is inevitable, but he's trying to sidestep. Judah says, we'll go, but we'll only go on the condition that Benjamin goes with us. For the man said, you shall not see my face, except your brother be with you. In verse 6, Jacob questioned why Benjamin was mentioned to the Egyptians in the first place. And this is really just a futile delay tactic, growing out of his frustration with his circumstances. But it is something his sons took as a personal affront. So in verse 7, in response to their father's complaint, the boys all speak at once and they answer him with a unified voice. They claim the Egyptian inquired about their clan. That would be a normal part of a conversation. And the information about Benjamin was given somewhat under distress. And verse 19 actually validates this as a proper conclusion. Something interesting stands out in verse 6. Jacob is referred there to, or in verse 6, by his God-given name, Israel. He's referred to as Israel a couple of times in this passage instead of Jacob. And you remember, Israel has not been used to refer to Jacob since chapter 37. So we have to ask the question, why the name change? Why was his name Israel used here? And I think his name is used here at this place. And this is kind of an important point for this text. I think his name was used here because the destiny of the theocratic nation is what's in view. It's not just one man's personal dilemma. There's something that goes beyond that historical issue that's at stake here. Migrating to Egypt is a step in God's plan to transform his chosen people into a great nation. And when we view this passage from that perspective, rather than as a difficulty faced by a single family, we see the weight of this matter. We see that there's a bigger issue at play. And the bigger issue is this. In addition to reconciling Joseph and his brothers and reuniting Jacob's family, there is this lofty goal of forming the new theocratic nation. In fact, this is the end to which God's invisible hand of providence is moving history. So, because God is at work to bring about his plan for the nation, Judah steps up and, with the intent of resolving Jacob's immediate concern, but by his words, unknowingly, he sets in motion the first steps toward forming the theocratic nation of Israel. So the stage is set. A return trip to Egypt is necessary, and an unalterable condition requires Benjamin to accompany his brothers back there to meet the man. Like it or not, Jacob is behind the eight ball. He has no choices. Judah won the day, but his victory didn't come without personal price. In verse 8, Judah's willingness to accept personal responsibility for Benjamin shows his own maturity, but it also highlights the gravity of this problem. His offer is not the absurd offer previously made by Reuben, slay my two sons if I don't return to him. I mean, think about that. You're worried about losing your children here, so just go kill a couple of your grandchildren if I don't come through as I promised. That's not what Judah does. That was ridiculous. What Judah says is a reasonable expression of the seriousness with which he takes the responsibility that he's taking on. He's willing to be considered guilty before his father if something happens. In verse 9, Judah further offers to be surety for him. Well, what does that mean? I think it means that if it comes down to a Judah or Benjamin decision in Egypt, Judah will surrender himself to the Egyptians in order to save the boy. He had not been willing to do that at Dothan. In verses 11 through 14, Jacob finally accepts the inevitability that Benjamin's going to Egypt. And he says, if it must be, do it. Go to the man. The last crisis Jacob faced of this magnitude was the confrontation with Esau. back in Genesis chapter 32. And he does here exactly what he did there. If you'll recall, he put together a gift for Esau, and he sent this gift out ahead of his clan in order to appease the anger of Esau. And he does the same thing here by putting together a gift that the boys are to take down to give to the man, whom of course is Joseph, in Egypt. But there's something more important than the gift, and it's in verse 14. It's the prayer that Jacob utters. He says, "May El Shaddai, God Almighty, grant mercy to you before the man, that he may send forth your brother Simeon and also Benjamin." This prayer simply asks for the best possible outcome. Jacob has expended every possible human solution, but human solutions are insufficient. So now he turns to God and he leaves the matter in his hands. In his prayer, he appeals to God by the name El Shaddai, which is translated in most English translations as God Almighty. It's a name that's very much associated with the Abrahamic covenant in the earlier chapters of Genesis. It's clear that Jacob believes El Shaddai is sovereign, not only over the affairs of Canaan, but he's sovereign over Egypt as well. This is consistent with what Jace was talking about in his sermon this morning. And another thing that's interesting, this is evidence that in the patriarchal period, in this time of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, El Shaddai was not seen as a tribal or localized deity, as some have claimed, but as the sovereign ruler of the universe. So there's this theory in ancient Near Eastern studies that reflect some historicity of some of the surrounding nations, that each nation or even each city had its own god, and that god was active in that particular localized region. But if you went to another city over here, you would be under the control of a different god. And so there's always been this type of thinking always creeps into Old Testament studies in the universities, and they'll try to depict these different names of God as God as he appeared over here versus someplace else. But in the context here, it's obvious that that's not how he's viewing El Shaddai, because El Shaddai, God Almighty, is not only sovereign over the events that are occurring in Canaan, he's also sovereign over the events that are occurring in Egypt. And to piggyback this to Jace's sermon, God is sovereign over Canaan, he's sovereign over Israel, but he's also sovereign over his people in Babylon as well during the captivity period. So not only does this divine name emphasize the unlimited power of God to bring about his will among men everywhere, that's the key term, but it's a name that's used frequently when the inability of man is contrasted with the omnipotent power of God. It's a name that underscores the sufficiency of God in contrast to the insufficiency of man. And I've included a partial verb study in your handout for your reading pleasure later as to how this particular name was derived through the Semitic languages. Notice also what Jacob is asking El Shaddai to do. He's asking him to direct Joseph's disposition, to influence the man's choices and decisions. There is no question that he understood that God's sovereignty involves the right and the ability to influence the decisions made by men. And this can be influencing and using the evil of some people for his ultimate glory, as well as good things as well. El Shaddai is the name that underscores the sufficiency of God, and that's really the thing to remember about this. He's asking this God, or his God, to bring his sons home safely, but he seeks this end by soliciting God to intervene with respect to the heart and thus with respect to the decisions of the man who holds Simeon in prison and who has the power of life and death over Benjamin. Jacob is acknowledging God has the power and the right to direct the hearts of men, not just in the family of Jacob, but everywhere, even the heart of the man he knows as a high-ranking Egyptian official. Jacob's prayer is not a timid expression of vague hope, but a powerful statement of faith. Faith in the God of the covenant, the God of Abraham and Isaac, the God of Bethel, the God who promised Jacob decades ago He would never leave him. Finally, after calling on God as El Shaddai, Jacob makes a very specific request, namely that Simeon and Benjamin will be returned to him safely. But notice something. Jacob accepts God's decision, whatever it may be. And I'm paraphrasing a bit, but he essentially says in his prayer, "Once, years ago, I was a childless man. Now, if God wills it, I will become so again." In verses 15 and 17, we see this hard decision that's before Jacob. His sons once again set out for Egypt. They took along with them three things: the gift, they took double the money for the grain, and they took Benjamin. And they went down to Egypt, and they stood once again before Joseph. Within the first moments of their arrival, several issues are settled for Joseph. First and maybe foremost, he knows Benjamin is alive and has not suffered a fate similar to his own at the hands of his brothers. That is a very important thing for Joseph to determine. It was important because it was important for Joseph to know this because he's about to bring these men into his house. Also, Joseph makes a reasonable deduction from their presence with Benjamin that since their words regarding Benjamin were true, perhaps their words regarding Jacob's well-being are true also. In other words, his younger brother, his presence lends veracity to their other claims. Keep in mind, this is a test. We talked about this previously. This is a test. Joseph can now move closer to the conclusion that perhaps these men have changed from the brothers he knew in his youth. But are they honest men as they claim? We aren't sure of that yet. The authority of Joseph to make decisions and his subordinates to follow them without question is very apparent in this passage. This is not the most important thing in here, but it does show how powerful the man was. Inviting these foreigners to his house for a meal, one of whom is brought over there from the prison, was highly irregular, but his orders were followed without so much as a question. Verses 18 to 22, the brothers are surprised, and so are the Egyptians. They can't fathom that this man would bring them into his home, not after the previous experiences that they've had with him. In fact, they think they're being set up, and in a sense they are. They conclude the issue is the returned money, and they fear the invitation will turn into an occasion for their arrest. And that's a reasonable conclusion. When they came down here for the previous time and they met with Joseph, on that last visit, he threw them in prison. Now he's inviting them for a meal in his home. Something doesn't add up. So rather than wait passively for their inevitable arrest, they approached the steward of Joseph's house about this matter. Verses 20 to 22, they once again make the claim of innocence, a tactic that already has been shown doesn't work, but they have no other option. They tell the steward about the returned money. They say to him they have it with them, they brought it back, and they also have other money with which to buy more grain. The steward's rather surprising response is bolstered by the appearance of Simeon, who's been brought to the house from prison. The words spoken by the steward are "Shalom lechem," peace to you. In other words, don't worry about the money. Don't fear. Everything's okay. Now, I don't know if they spoke to the steward through a translator, or maybe he was the translator, because there are a couple of different languages involved here. There's Hebrew and there's Egyptian. So somehow they're able to communicate, and he tries to belay their fears. And the steward continues speaking with them, and he says something very interesting. He says, "Fear not, your God, even the God of your father, has given you a hidden treasure." And then he says, "I had your money." Now this is a bit cryptic. We know the steward returned the money, but he attributes his act to God. What does he know about Joseph? What does he know about the God Joseph worships? What interests me is his choice of words. I don't know why he uttered the specific phrase unless Joseph told him exactly what to say. We're also not told if this man is a believer. You know, maybe he is. Perhaps Joseph has instructed him in the ways of the Lord. Perhaps we'll meet this man in heaven. I don't know. It's an intriguing thought. But whatever the case, there's a subtle lesson to be learned from the words he speaks. By saying, God has given you a treasure, when it was he who placed the money in their bags, he knowingly or unknowingly is stating a theological truth, that God accomplishes his plans through human agents. And is it not the lesson behind the whole Joseph story? Namely, that God is using the actions of men, both the good actions and the bad actions, to accomplish his eternal purpose. So we come now to verses 26 to 31. And theology aside, it's noon. The hour's come, and Joseph has arrived to share a meal with his brothers. Their gift is brought into the house, and it's presented to Joseph. We're not told anything about his reaction to it. I suspect he was far more interested in what was about to take place, and particularly the presence of his younger brother Benjamin. Instead of acknowledging a gift, Joseph immediately turns to the more important issue, Jacob's welfare. He says, "Is the old man of whom you spoke still alive?" And they replied, "Yes," and they bowed before him. After inquiring about Jacob, Joseph turned his attention then to Benjamin. Notice in verse 29, and by the way, that verse uses an interesting phrase, "and he lifted up his eyes." Almost exclusively, when you see that phrase in the Old Testament, it's used to introduce something that's of extreme importance. So it's kind of a little trigger to take special note of what follows. "And he lifted up his eyes." So we can conclude here that this is Joseph's turning his attention to Benjamin, and that Benjamin is the thing of highest importance in this story. Here Benjamin is described as his mother's son. Of all these, all of these men are sons of Jacob, all of them. But only Joseph and Benjamin are the sons of Joseph, of Jacob and Rachel. Joseph then asks, "Is this your younger brother of whom you spoke?" He never actually allows them to answer that question because he already knows the answer. It's all Joseph can do at this point to maintain his composure. So he utters only a single comment, "May God be gracious to you, my son." We see in verse 30, Joseph is overcome by emotion. He excused himself from the room and he went into a private place, and there he wept. It's one of those verses where, try as we may, it probably isn't possible to understand fully what Joseph was feeling. Seeing his brothers before him, knowing Jacob still alive, having Benjamin in his home was an overwhelming experience for him. Benjamin probably was a year or two old the last time Joseph had seen him. Now he's a young man. 22 years or so have passed. Joseph's reaction is predictable. His emotions were stirred within him. The word that is used to express what he was feeling is kamar. It's translated in the NASB as "he was deeply stirred." Its lexical meaning is to grow warm. It's used only two other times in the Old Testament. It appears in 1 Kings 3:26 to describe the feelings of a young mother whose child is on the verge of death. And it's used in Hosea 11:8, expressing God's deep love for Israel. So you can see this is a very emotional time for Joseph. It should be apparent what's happening. Up until now, Joseph has been simply the man. The brothers have been subordinates. We're beginning to see relational terms creep into the text. Benjamin is now his brother. Benjamin is referred to as his mother's son, revealing an unspoken bond between Joseph and Benjamin. Eventually, Joseph recovers and returns to the room, and he orders that the meal be served. The meal's quite interesting. Once again, Joseph is recreating an old scene. We talked about this previously, and in your handout you'll see, I tried to kind of outline some of that for you. He's creating an old scene. The last time his brothers had a meal in his presence, Joseph was in a pit in Dothan. That day his brothers casually dined while Joseph pleaded for his life in the pit he was separated from his brothers. Here again, this time dictated by cultural demands, the brothers dine separately from Joseph. But as mentioned in previous lessons, the tables this time are turned. The meal served in Joseph's house, and it takes place on Joseph's terms, not theirs. So notice first the seating arrangement. This had to have blown their minds. As previously mentioned, Joseph and the Egyptians are seated separately from the Hebrews. The reason for this is given in verse 32. The Egyptians could not eat bread with the Hebrews, for that is an abomination to the Egyptians. There's a very strong word here that's translated abomination that actually means disgusting, and it carries the sense of physical repugnance. Remember, the Egyptians were racists, violently so. They would not allow assimilation. When Israel did come down into the nation, he was separated in Goshen from the culture of the Egyptians. This is why God chose to put them in Egypt and not someplace else, because he knew they would be separate. But Joseph is not a racist, nor is he repulsed by the Hebrews, for he is a Hebrew, but he's presenting himself as an Egyptian as part of his plan to test his brothers. But there's something else that's noteworthy about the seating arrangements. Apparently, they had place cards designating where each man was to sit. I don't really think they did. But somehow, their way of seating and the positions in which they were seated were prearranged by Joseph. Read in verse 33, "And they sat before him, the firstborn to his, according to his birthright, and the youngest according to his youth. And the men marveled one to the other." So what does this mean? It means his brothers were seated according to their birthdays. For this to occur is either the greatest of all coincidences that have ever occurred, or Joseph knew when each of these men was born. To begin with, they're shocked at the prospect of dining with such a great man, an Egyptian at that. But their surprise turned to absolute amazement when they realized they were seated in the order of their births. How could he know this? And if he knows this, what else must he know? Maybe he knows about Joseph, but how could he know these things? Guilt plays funny games with the mind. The word that describes their reaction is tamah, astonished. The root meaning of this word is to be dumbfounded, to be bewildered. And the word carries with it an innate element of fear. This scared them to death. And they were surprised because the point here is that someone knows something and something's going on that we don't understand. From the vocabulary that describes their reaction to the seating arrangements, we see a group of men who are overcome by a sense of impending judgment, if not doom. In their minds, this is the beginning of the reckoning predicted by Judah back in chapter 42. Verse 34 closes the chapter with Joseph pressing on with his plan to test his brothers by pushing them to the breaking point. And remember, Joseph is juxtaposing the past onto the present, but all the roles are now reversed. But there's more. Joseph sent portions to them from his own table. The Hebrew text says from his own mouth, but we shouldn't take that literally. And Benjamin's portion was five times that of his brothers. So what's going on? Why is Benjamin, the youngest brother, singled out and given a larger portion than the older brothers? Well, looking back, Joseph was the favored son of Jacob. As such, he became the object of his brother's jealousy and hatred. We talked a lot about the dysfunction of Jacob's family earlier in this study. And it's a discredit to Jacob that he favored Joseph over his other sons. But their reaction to his favoritism, which turned jealousy into hatred and eventually into violence, also was wrong. Joseph was almost killed, only to be saved by Judah at the last minute. Nevertheless, even then he was saved only to be sold to the Ishmaelites and sent to Egypt to be a slave. In the ancient Near East, giving a larger portion at meals was a sign of favoritism. It was a singling out for special treatment. The recipient of the larger portion was not expected to eat all that was placed before him, although as a young teenager, he probably could have. Just ask Linda. It was a symbolic gesture, a gesture designed to recreate the special treatment Joseph received that led to his being dispossessed by his brothers. What will these same men do when Rachel's other son, Benjamin, is singled out? What will happen when the youngest son is given primacy over the older sons? Will Joseph see a glimpse of the old hatred? This is the point of this test. Joseph further stacks the deck against his brothers in another way. He made certain that a large quantity of wine was served. Now, I tried to visualize this meal and how everyone was seated and how the things happened. And I would bet Joseph is seated apart from his brothers, but he's facing them. This is what's meant by the phrase, they were seated before him. It means they were seated in front of him. He's facing them so he can observe the expressions on their faces. The wine is served first, and it was the best wine Joseph had to offer. I would bet there was an unforeseen minor delay in the kitchen that caused the meal to be just a few minutes late coming off the roaster. But no problem. In the meantime, just have another glass of wine. I also suspect Joseph appeared to drink more wine than he actually consumed, so his head would be clear to observe his brothers. And something tells me with their nerves on edge, the brothers were not vigilant in controlling their own consumption of the aperitif. This is designed to lower their inhibitions. So when this larger portion is served to Benjamin, if there's any hint of jealousy, Joseph will see it, and he certainly knows what to look for. Of all the brothers, it's Joseph who inherited the shrewdness of Jacob and Rebekah. But with this difference, Joseph used his shrewdness for good, whereas Jacob and Rebekah didn't always make good choices. Bruce Waltke once said, "The salvation of the world depended on one descendant of the patriarchs." He was referring to Joseph. In this chapter, Joseph demonstrates his wisdom and his ability to lead. He also has a God-given talent for thinking ahead, and he seems always to stay one step ahead of everyone else. Throughout the history of Israel, Joseph stands as a testament to Israeli kings that they're responsible for preserving righteousness in the nation. Envy, jealousy, hatred among God's people will wreck the unity of Israel if left unchecked. We can take the same lesson to heart in the church age. Envy, jealousy, and hatred among God's people will wreck the unity of the church if left unchecked. In Genesis 43, Joseph tested his brothers in order to know their hearts. By singling out and giving precedence to Benjamin, Joseph gave his brothers an opportunity to react with envy, jealousy, and hatred toward their youngest brother, just as they had toward him. But to their credit, they didn't. The theme of favoritism in the chapter is balanced by the emphasis on God's grace. And I want you to consider three examples of this. Verse 14, may God Almighty give you mercy before the man. In verse 23, peace to you. God has given you a treasure in your sacks. And in verse 29, may God be gracious to you, my son. The first occurrence is in Jacob's prayer. Grace is the foundation on which that prayer is offered. The second occurrence is the steward's response to their plea for mercy. And the third occurrence is Joseph's blessing of Benjamin. Throughout the Joseph narratives, grace always trumps human failure. But the testing isn't over for Joseph's brothers. They still have some left before them. They've taken a giant step toward reconciliation. There's no doubt about it. But there's more to come. They still have to survive chapter 44. Well, are they going to survive that? Do you think they'll make it?
I read ahead.
You read ahead? Yeah.
Can you clarify?